Fair warning, the following contains disturbing sexual imagery and criminality. The names and identifying information of the perpetrator of these crimes and of victims have been changed to protect all concerned. Everyone listening should proceed with a thoughtful consideration of utmost caution. These are real crimes committed by real people. Human sexuality fills the space between pleasure and desperation, reflecting the limits of our flawed understanding of the most intimate part of who we are. Around us, cinematic fantasies of violence and larceny, of terrorism and despair, are presented as entertainment. And then, as we approach sexual criminality, all fantasies become guilty until proven otherwise. We come to a place where ignorance is the last stop as sex becomes crime. You have now entered Sex Crime Central. His name is Vince Capurro. Vince has 44 years under his belt, and he feels the weight of every single one of those years. His occupation? Hard to say. Vince has worked at every 7-Eleven you've ever driven by. Back when Radio Shack was a thing, he was that guy behind the counter. In better days, he'd had enough uninformed hope to go to L.A. to write music while waiting to be discovered, along with 50,000 other hopeful musicians. But none of these misbegotten hopes panned out. A smart man, Vince had gone to 2 different colleges, but he never developed the necessary passion to set aside either his vodka or his pot. At present, Vince has moved back home with his elderly parents, and now he's back in the basement, its darkness and privacy comforting him. His state of mind. Vince is terrified of women, of growing older, of being poor, of everything he cannot treat with a strong dose of chemical oblivion. 44 years old, going nowhere and getting there alone. Well, everything may not seem to be working out fine, but things have improved, especially since Vince Capurro met the helpful staff at Sex Crime Central, a staff that is always ready to help travelers make their connections. There's a type of knock at the door that once you hear it, you never forget it. Experienced citizens call it the cop knock. Vince Capurro had heard that knock before during 2 of his 3 arrests for driving under the influence. He'd always beaten those charges before. After all, his was a small town where everybody knew everybody else. People tried to help one another in a small town, and both the town folk and Vince's parents kept helping him, and if they had been successful, they would have put him in an early grave, deep enough for him to hide forever. He already knew the drill because he was a pro who'd started drinking every weekend since 8th grade. Your parents pay for you to go to rehab. You'd be a good boy and cut back to only a couple of cocktails every day while on probation. Then, when probation is over, book another appointment with that nice Dr. Vodka. But Vince knew he hadn't been driving, so he wondered what a cop could possibly want from him. When he answered the door, he was confronted with the faces of people he'd never seen around town before. This was different, and he was confused by the presence of these strangers. The men in black, were part of a federal task force assigned to investigate sex crimes. Not a problem, thought Vince. I haven't been what you'd call sexual with anyone in years. And with that, he thought back to the years since he'd left high school. He'd been one of the smartest kids in school, bit of a snob, really. Even though he was too small to be a bully physically, Vince loved intellectual bullying. He always provided the right answers, waiting until just every single other person had failed. He'd gotten into a rhythm. Be smart all week in school, drink like you were going to die without it Friday night and all day Saturday. And every Sunday, he'd be back at Mass, singing in the choir. And really, even after years of trying heroin, opium, cocaine, LSD, mushrooms, and mescaline, Vince always returned to his first true love, Ethyl, ethyl alcohol. Over the years, there were more than a few women in Vince's life, 5, 6, maybe 7. He never lived with any of them for more than a month or two. Things just didn't seem to work out. And now, tired of school, tired of being broke, tired of failing, and tired of even trying to do, God, he didn't even know what he was trying to do, Vince went back home to his elderly parents, who made him a comfy place in the basement just as he preferred. He never had had any more luck with friendships than he did with women, but that was okay. He had plenty of other stuff to do, and besides, now he did have a job. He was unloading trucks at the local grocery. He continued to masturbate as he had for years before coming home, and now, in the 15 years since he's returned, he had his basement set up with all the bells and whistles. He had his video games, his supply of Cheese Whiz, and he'd rediscovered pot. Why did I ever give this up? He wondered. Alone and lonely, masturbation was the only sexual outlet Vince had. As he'd aged, Vince found that the women he really wanted to be with were increasingly unavailable to him due to his own failures as a man. His substance-abusing lifestyle led him from relationship failures to the stalling of his academic career to the paralysis of his work life, which cumulatively led to the near-extinguished existence he'd lived as an unemployed, middle-aged man living in the dark confines of his elderly parents' basement, spending the last year or more collecting and masturbating to pictures of underage children. What choice did he have? After all, what adult woman would ever want to seek out a man like Vince for companionship? He'd wondered why he was using photographs of children and not adult pornographic images anymore. But then he realized that he was overwhelmed with and afraid of adult women. They were far too competent, far too powerful for him to deal with. Children felt much safer to him because, although he's a very intelligent man, Vince had never matured emotionally. And he feels so much more in control, so much safer, just with his fantasies of being able to approach children. Vince, lost in his thoughts, came to himself, looked up at the FBI agents. "Come on in," he said. "I think I know why you're here." Regular listeners to this podcast know that I like to talk about the criminogenic variables that help explain the slow diminution of anyone's ability to make competent judgments in life. And with this particular case, Vince has a number, and I'm going to invite you as a regular listener to go ahead and, you know, take a minute and write down the ones that you think that might have been there, because we'll eventually probably come up with some kind of a contest to see who can get in the number first. I found 8. He had a dearth of social skills, a dearth of intimacy skills. 3, he had a profound fear of women and social situations. 4, this profound fear was pervasive and enduring, leading to a diagnosis of avoidant personality disorder, where in his case, it was like his pathological shyness was an irresistible force meeting an immovable object in the form of his adult male sex drive. 5, he obviously had a substance abuse problem, and mostly just with booze at this point in his life. 6, he had no career, and men who buy into a career and enjoy it really have a sense of accomplishment that is missing in the lives of men who have no real career. He had no friends to confront him, to encourage him, to bring him along to social events. And lastly, he had no love life. He had no socially acceptable sexual outlet where he could express his sexuality in a way that would be honorable and legal by society's standards. Criminogenic, for those of you who haven't heard me talk about this before, if you think of the word itself, criminogenic breaks down easily into the word crime and Genesis, like the first book of the Bible. This is a discussion of the beginnings of the crime. And the reason I like to talk about this is because instead of merely reacting to sexual criminality and, in effect, rushing to shut the barn doors after the horses have already gotten out, we could get ahead of sexual criminality, especially those of us who really do care about victims. We could prevent victimization of so many thousands of Americans every year simply by being aware of the warning signs that any individual who had these warning signs would really need some help in overcoming these limitations. So criminogenic variables, and Vince has 8 of them. So,
well, thank you for going over a little bit more about why we talk about this on the podcast. And because I have to be honest, after the last few, it's like, why are we talking about these, you know, terrible stories? And I know the listeners, including myself, want to know what happened to Vince.
You know, I'd like to think so. And I think people who are listening to this are in that category. But, you know, even those of us who are fascinated by this can remember a time in our lives where we would skim over a headline, maybe read a few words, maybe the whole darn article describing a sex crime, and then just shake our heads in disgust and wonder, you know, what are we going to do with these people? Should we like vote them off the island? Should we put them in prison for the rest of their lives? This is a very different way of thinking. That earlier way of thinking is really about the tickling of my amygdala, where I feel frightened and I go into my fight or flight. In this case, we've got him in handcuffs or sitting in a jail. And so we want to fight him because, right, we're safe. But we mentally flee from these kinds of thoughts because they're so upsetting. And instead, I'd invite the listeners right now to think in terms of being a medical pathologist who has to go ahead and dissect a body and forensically determine what went wrong. How did this person come to die? Mm-hmm. I'd like to do the same thing with every sex crime that I encounter, because if I could understand what led to the impoverished capacity for judgment, I think I could understand how he came to commit the crime. And that's going to involve some real slow thinking, you know, where people talk about this stuff, listen to a podcast like this, and really think about, you know, some of these cases. It's really the story behind the story, as far as I'm concerned. And sadly, it's the story that never gets covered by journalists, you know, when they're writing about sex crimes.
Ever. I mean, you never hear this aspect. And I don't want it to be misconstrued that us talking about, you know, someone like Vince and his past leading up to his crime and all these different variables, like we're somehow giving him the sympathy in the situation. But if, like you said, if we can really look at some of these aspects that are pretty consistent throughout a lot of the crimes that we're hearing, if there was a way to identify those sooner and prevent them, then this really could be a game changer.
Well, God, yes. I got to tell you, I've encountered a lot of hostility with this, with just engaging in this kind of thinking, because I get accused in the minds of the listener of making excuses for the sex criminal, when actually we're just looking for an understanding of how it all came to happen. Mm-hmm. And an understanding is not by any means excusing. You know, to understand is not to excuse. Those are two separate ways of thinking altogether. But for me, you know, the hostility is interesting, because people who react with a lot of agitation to an explanation, they're sensing an internal readiness to start understanding. And the idea of understanding how a sex offender comes to commit a crime bothers them a lot. There's an old French saying, to understand is to forgive. And I think for some people, the idea of humanizing a sex offender into something other than a monster is so frightening in and of itself, because maybe it means I could become a sex offender. Maybe anybody could be a sex offender. And for whatever reason, it just feels safer for a lot of people to stay hating.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to think about anything. There are no details to fuss over. You get to just stay safe in your anger and your resentment. But that doesn't prevent sex crimes. And that's, you know, Vince, he was born a beautiful baby boy, just like any other little boy out there. And if we'd asked him when he was 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old, 14 years old, would you like to grow up to be a sex offender? Of course, he would have said no, like everybody else. Nobody wants to grow up to become a sex offender. However, so many thousands do. So somehow they've lost their way. And I'd like to think of our discussion as a way of maybe helping people foresee into the future what they need to start taking care of, you know, like with Vince, just early on in his life, you could see that he was lacking the social skills necessary to reach out and form platonic connections with other boys, and then later as a man, with other men. He never developed those skills. Those skills are kind of elementary to those who have them, and we don't really think about teaching them, but for the person who doesn't have the ability to even think, how would I initiate social contact? How would I introduce myself? And all the irrational beliefs around that. If I go try to talk to them, they'll just think I'm stupid. And to work through all of that shyness. Now, in Vince's case, he has avoidant personality disorder,
which I've never actually heard of before.
You know who? It's because of those guys who claim all the limelight, the narcissists and the antisocials. But among the sex offender treatment population, my experience has been that avoidance, personality disorder patients, avoidance are by far the more common.
Interesting.
And they're far more numerous than they are in the general population. And again, it's that irresistible force meeting an immovable object. And the force, in his case, is always the adult male sex drive. And the immovable object is that rigid shyness that keeps me from, you know, wanting to make a move or do anything different. So I'm just paralyzed in my shyness, but I'm still a sexual being and I still want some sort of sexual gratification. It's a pretty sweet trap for any human being to find themselves in, because without help, there's really almost nothing one can do about it.
Well, you mentioned that he kind of knew the drill with his parents. He had been, what I assume, in and out of rehab surrounding his substance abuse with alcohol. Did he ever receive any therapy that you know of with while he was in those treatments, or was he just skirting around really opening up on any of his issues?
Well, he did receive standard treatment while in rehab.
Yeah.
And this is probably where I'm going to piss off a lot of people talking about things this way, but rehab is really pretty much designed to be all about the substance abuse.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, most people use substances or abuse substances for a reason, usually a good reason. They're terrified of life, and they get some Dutch courage in themselves, and they're able to go up and talk to people. They're miserably depressed, but they can, you know, enter into oblivion and leave their pain behind if they get drunk enough. And a lot of that was going on in Vince's life. And so a guy like that goes to a rehab, and he, along with all the other people who need the help the most, are often met by the least competent people in the mental health industry. And they're all about the substance abuse, but none of the undergirding reasons that drive the person to the substance abuse. And the reason that is true is because of the economics of the model. You know, the corporations that run rehabs make a lot more money if they use low-paid professionals to do that. And the lowest-paid professionals in the industry of mental health are the substance abuse counselors. So they are, and also, of course, the interns. And these kinds of businesses hire a lot of interns, a lot of substance abuse counselors, but that's about it. Of course, there has to be one person, you know, the medical director who's in charge, but the actual level of service is really low. He had no idea what his diagnoses were. He had no idea that he had avoidant personality disorder was a thing or that it was something he was struggling with. He had really, I think, embraced the moral diagnosis. He was just a fuck up. He was never going to amount to anything. But goddamn, he was smarter than everybody else. So he had that to hold on to. Mm-hmm. Smarter than everybody, but that was the end of his positive traits.
So what happened to Vince?
Well, the rest of the story in Vince's case, after I met him, he was eligible to be sentenced to probation. He ended up going to prison. And I think it was because of the time in American history and the number of photographs and movies he had of underage children. There was really no chance he was going to get probation. So he went to prison for a number of years. And he finally got out. He went back home to his small town where he, in 2016, he failed to register as a sex offender. He was rearrested and charged again with this second sex crime for failing to register. And then shortly thereafter, there was a call to the fire department and a house was on fire. And the firefighters were barely able to get in to see if they could rescue anybody. And one of them did carry him out, but it was too late. He was already dead, along with a couple of his cats. He had a house full of cats. He turned into that person, you know, the cat guy.
Wait, so how did the fire start? Did they ever
determine that? The authorities determined that the fire had started on a hot plate that was on the stove, but they never determined whether it was intentional or not. By this time, his elderly parents had already passed on, and financially, he was a bit at the end of his rope. And so it's possible that he may have killed himself or that it may have been an accident. We'll never know. You know, so here's a kid. He was raised the right way. He had wonderful parents, never had any serious problems in the home, never had any serious problems at school, graduated, and should have gone on. I mean, he was at least on that superficial level primed for success. And then nothing worked. The wheels fell off the wagon and nothing worked for him. So there you are. What would we do different? I think paying attention to those banal things that so many of us take for granted. Why doesn't my son have any friends? What can I do to help him learn how to make friends?
That communication with your children, obviously, because he was so painfully shy that he wasn't progressing in any type of social skills. And
you know, he'd stay busy. He'd be at home reading, or he'd be at home later on as he got older playing video games. But he was sublimating because we're a social species, or at least we are members of a social species. And we all need people in our lives to be normal. You know, of course, we have those Ted Kaczynskis out there who go off into the woods and live with the critters and are very messed up. But a lot of Ted Kaczynski types live among us. They just go home. They're perfectly polite, and then they go home from their job, and they never talk to anybody or do anything different. It didn't help that he had been drinking since he was 14, I think. And that's, I think it's highly suspicious that it's right around the time that he hit puberty, because I think he was just, his fear level, I think, went through the roof, and I think drinking really helped him a lot.
Kind of hindered that development.
Yes, of course, it kept him from maturing emotionally, because we can only mature by going through experiences. And he was avoiding those experiences by staying drunk and avoiding people. So yeah, that was a real problem. And again, had he been taken into a treatment center as a teenager for a substance abuse problem, again, none of the underlying issues would have been met. So the only women he ever really got involved with were fellow problem drinkers, women with drug problems, and consequently, he was always lonely, and he never had a meaningful connection to anyone. And I think that really explains how a guy becomes fixated on internet porn. And this individual in particular became, I would say, something of a rare case in that he not only looked at pictures of underage children, but his primary fantasies were about underage children. He taught himself to become a pedophile.
When you say he taught himself, I know that you mentioned that he just felt like women were too scary, they were too powerful, they were too much for him to deal with. So was it him sort of reverting back into that childlike state that then...
Yeah, it was a better time in his life. And if you talk to women who are super tall or super intelligent or super pretty, they've got stories about how intimidated men can be. Mm-hmm. Well, he found every woman to be so much more than he could
handle. Every adult woman.
Yeah. Yes, every adult woman. So redundant. Yes, every adult woman was just too much for him. So he was trapped, you know, and he that could have been prevented. There's treatment for every one of the problems that beset him, but he never got diagnosed and he was never offered treatment. And then when he got out of prison, he never got the treatment then either and went on to die in a fire.
Were you working with him after he got out of prison?
I never saw him again. Once he left prison, I never saw him again. Vince Capurro had everything going for him. Vince never had any real problems with his parents, and why would he? They never drank or used drugs. They never committed criminal acts. They never gambled. None of the problems of modernity dared show its face in their home. But there were clues from the very beginning that something was wrong. Vince never had friends. Nobody ever came over to the house to play with him. He didn't have any friends at all. He'd never had a girlfriend in his younger years. And career? Vince had dreams. Dreams of stardom as a musician and a songwriter, but he had never developed a career plan, much less Plan B. Vince Capurro possessed a normal adult male sex drive that crashed headfirst into his pathological level of shyness. His drinking both comforted him and made matters much worse over his lifetime. But child porn? He did not see that coming, at least not as a problem. After all, he was alone in his parents' basement. Everything was as private and lonely as can be. But when the porters from Sex Crime Central came to help him with his bags, Vince pushed his chin in the direction of his computer and said, "There you are. I don't know why I did this."
You're listening to Sex Crime Central with psychotherapist Stephen Ng. This has been an Ng Intellectual production with original score by Octophonics, audio production by Steve Cooper, and video production by Jesse McCloskey. Follow Stephen on social media platforms at Stephen Ng MFT or visit StephenNg.com for more information. Don't forget to subscribe to Sex Crime Central and leave us a review with your thoughts on each episode. We'd love to hear from you.